I'll get it. You are listening to radio station WBAI 99.5 FM, New York. The evening is Wednesday. The time is 7 p.m. The program is Off the Hook. Is Off the Hook. Rob T. Firefly here with you on this Wednesday evening, and I am joined here by Gila.
Hello, good evening.
Hello, and out in Signal Land, we have Alex.
You do. Good evening.
Oh, that was loud. Not on your end, Alex, on mine, because I am fiddling terribly with a board here. All right, that's better. That's a lot better. And also out in Signal Land, we professional radio makers here have a couple of wonderful guests. We have Jason Scott.
Salutations. Am I too loud?
Nope, you're okay, but my board is just all over the place. This is the sort of thing that, one should really get sorted out before a radio broadcast. We have another guest. We have Kusanagi with us.
Hi. Howdy, howdy.
Hello. Now, it is August. It is mid-August. It is conference season here in the hacker world. And things are just happening all over the place. DEF CON just happened in Vegas. There was one called Y in the Netherlands.
I don't know.
There was one. Let's try that again. There was a conference called Y in the Netherlands?
Why not in the Netherlands? I'm trying here. I really am.
Okay.
But yes, it is conference season. I thought you were just aiming for, like, it's the dog days of summer, because it definitely is. I know I haven't been traveling to any conferences, but anyone in Signal Land?
Let's see. Actually, I did something conference adjacent, which is there's this interesting little outdoor movie theater in New Jersey where they take over a farmer's market and show a film. And I shot a DEF CON documentary, a little more than 10 years ago, and they had me come out. I think they liked the fact that I don't charge to license the movie. And they gave me some candy, and it was just a really good time out in the summer watching DEF CON with an audience of like 15 people who had no idea what hacker cons were. That's always the great thing is, what are hacker cons when you say it to people? I'm like, well, here's this two-hour movie, which is maybe not the best way to ramp people up into it. But that was how I spent conference season so far. And, of course, I have a few appointments later this weekend.
Later this weekend. What's happening later this weekend, folks?
I know I'm going to St. John's University because I was invited to come speak and play around at the Hackers on Planet Earth conference. And you people are rapidly turning me into a mascot, which I think is very funny. I keep getting like, could you show up to this part? Could you do this part? And I always like to dress up for the occasion. And I have to get more suits.
That's why we pick you for the part, because you dress up in the suits. And
yeah.
You're very flashy, very eye-catching, and, mascots should be, flashy, eye-catching, maybe a little sparkly.
A little sparkly, little thing. That's what people think of when they think of Queens. Which, by the way, my family's from, so it's nice to return home for a bit.
It's also where Gila and I are.
It certainly is. And your ancestral homeland will be happy to have you back.
Absolutely. And so there's a lot going on this week in the hacker world, the technical world. I want to talk about a couple of things that have happened. One of them is this story that appeared on Tom's Hardware. Who remembers AOL?
Oh, I do.
Oh, yeah, I know this story, unfortunately. This one broke my heart a little bit.
Well, AOL has decided to sunset its dial-up internet service in September, 34 years after it started. AOL Shield Browser and the AOL Dialer software will be shuttered on the same day. Now, AOL holds a certain place in the history of, I think, the general human-populated internet. Kind of fitting that they're ending it in September, which is apparently no longer eternal.
I don't think September is as eternal as it used to be, but this, I'm reasonably willing to say, feels like a generational loss. For people who are roughly of my age bracket, that does include you. And, no, oh my goodness, I remember going off to college and having to search for the dial-up numbers in the new city where I was living and trying to figure out, you know, what would be a long-distance call based on the area codes. And say what you will about AOL, and God knows there's a lot to be said, but I think having it be that first little toehold that enabled so many people to at least get started in all kinds of different things, and, you know, a little launchpad. And I know it's not the end of AOL per se, right? But the end of the dial-up service. And, you know, the modems don't sing that little song anymore. I will not favor you with it right now, though.
Alex, what's up?
Well, I have to say, I didn't have that experience with AOL. I mean, I'm sad to see that they're shuttering the dial-up service. It's certainly the end of an era. But to my mind, I was always just way too cool to use AOL back in the day. Mm-hmm. I mean, AOL, sorry, Gila, but it was for what we used to call lamers. Back in the 90s.
I will gladly accept that.
Yeah, lamers, and that's definitely with a Z at the end of it, because that's what we did on BBSs way back in the day. And so, I mean, my internet access or dial-up access was really limited to BBSs at first, I guess starting at around 1993, 1994. And then I used to freak phone calls to various full internet service providers, either, you know, located across the country, and you use some kind of illicit means in order to make those telephone calls and avoid the toll charges, or local internet service providers like li.net way back in the day on Long Island. You remember that, Rob?
I could tell you a story about them, yeah.
Oh, I would like to hear the story about li.net since we're talking about dial-up internet. I mean, I thought they had a pretty interesting service. I had a way of creating a whole bunch of fake accounts on them and never getting billed way back in the day. But I could never bring myself down to the level of using an AOL account because it was too simple. The graphical user interface was too clean. And it was like the simple way of accessing the internet. I'm looking back at it now, you know, and it was a very prejudicial attitude and very condescending attitude to take towards AOL users. But, you know, that's what we did back in the day.
That was the general attitude, too, among internet nerds of the time. AOL represented the general populace having access to this world that had only hitherto been populated by fellow nerds.
You're darn Skippy. And that's the thing, because my dad was very techie. He was an early adopter of a lot of things, and we had, you know, dial-up internet at probe.net, which was a local ISP by us, and he created a domain for us, and I tried to, you know, set up my own web page, and it was frustrating, to say the least, so I kind of huffed away from that kind of experience. And then when AOL became a thing, mm-hmm. that was great. Plus, you know, I don't think the appeal of Instant Messenger can be understated. Or can be overstated, really.
So I, of course, got pinged a lot because of my BBS history about this dial-up change.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, a couple years ago, I did an experiment, or I should say research, to go, how many dial-up BBSs are left? And the answer at the time was, like, 23. And the and all of them are, like, you know, the remnant while all the main business is being done through its internet connection. But when this dial-up announcement about AOL disappeared or came onto the scene, somebody pointed out that as part of the 2020 census, they asked about household connectivity. So in the 2020 census, 160,000 people were on dial-up or some form of dial-up in the United States. That was the remaining amount, still primarily communicating with the internet via modems.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you're not allowed by law to discuss AOL without discussing AOL CDs. And a few years ago at the archive, at the Internet Archive where I work, I put out the word that I wanted as many unique AOL CDs as possible. And I got a lot of pushback, which is great. Anger is a feeling. Good get feelings. And I pointed out that from, you know, basically the mid-1990s, 94 to at least 99, AOL was half of all CDs produced in the United States. So historically, they are important. And I had, I think, a couple dozen, maybe 100-some-odd different AOL CDs because, thank goodness, they each had unique part numbers when they made shifts.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like I said, people had their responses, but like three or four years later, I had a contact from a woman who was like, do you want all of them? And I said, yes, I would like all of them. Turned out she was the lawyer for Time Warner and AOL, and her job was to be given each new variation of a CD and do a legal vetting. You know, do the graphics look like they infringe? Does the content infringe? And she just kept them all.
Wow.
So it's 6,500 variations that came out over the years. And I've got some weird ones. As you can imagine, by the second half of AOL CD arc, people know what they're getting in the mail.
Mm-hmm.
So the second half is nothing but something landing on your door going, I'm not an AOL CD, you should open me up, I might be important. Or case made of clay, like tile clay, so when you picked it up, you said, oh, no, I sure have some important thing I'm getting in the mail. And no, it's an AOL CD in a clay case. And
wow.
It was like that. It's like, I think I've got a book in it maybe sometime in the future because it's like the artistic variation.
I would read that, yeah.
It'd be a great book. I'll do it for Toshin, and it will be $7,500, and it will come signed by Steve Case, and everybody will buy 19 of them.
There is one AOL CD. There is one AOL CD that I think I still have in a box somewhere, and it is one that came attached to the front of an issue of Mad Magazine. And when you put out this call, I took a look to see if that one was already out there, and I think it's already up on the archive. But Mad Magazine had done some sort of promotional thing where not only did they attach the CD that had some musical tracks of theirs and a couple of pieces of software that I think ran on DOS, but also there was the signing up for AOL kit. And it is wild, and it's got Alfred E. Newman's face as the disc art.
Naturally, with his nose in the hole, I'm assuming.
I think so. But
did I tell you about the set piece we constructed for the school play when I was in college? So this is completely true. I went to a teeny tiny university, but AOL had seen university, so they sent us 1,000 discs. The problem with that is that the student body at my university was about 60. So we were dealing with a surplus of AOL CDs. We had nothing to do with them. And we were getting ready for the play that the drama class was putting on. And we needed to build some sort of futuristic set piece of some kind. So we got a bunch of dowels and a bunch of clear string-ish, and poked holes in the dowels and tied the CDs in the holes, and we called it the Orchard of the Future. And then the whole thing collapsed, and someone was just standing in a pile of 100 AOL CDs just everywhere. It was a magic moment for all of us, and I'm really glad I was able to be there, and I'm really glad I told you about it now.
Absolutely. The most shocking thing about AOL CDs was that they worked. Like, people may convince themselves it didn't work. It worked. It turned out if you just coat the landscape in plastic CDs, you will get new signups. You were saying?
I'm just surprised that it stood up at all. I mean, collapsing on top of somebody into a giant mound of 100 AOL CDs. I think that just, I think it was like a sign of the times to come.
Oh, absolutely.
Indeed. The CD era, though, was preceded by the AOL floppy disk era, and they would stick 3.5-inch floppies to the covers of magazines, and because these were being stuck on magazines and, like, thrown on bookshelves and sent through the mail and everything, they actually used really good quality floppies. And I think enough time has passed where I can admit that if AOL back then had somehow gotten the idea that your address was a modest computer store that needed some floppies for boxes on their counter, they would send you box after box of really good floppies that you could then flick the little switch on and reformat and have blank floppies for all your data desires.
This is purely a hypothetical statement, though, right? Like, for legal purposes, I feel like we're required to say that's a purely hypothetical construct.
If they're willingly sending you, then, you know, and you're willingly, you know, taking the mail that's legally yours, I don't see any issues here. Like, besides, the statute of limitations is long expired at this point.
I would hope.
Yeah. There are many statutes of limitations that I'm glad expired since the 90s. But moving on. Another story in the news that I thought was particularly interesting. Illinois, about a week ago, became the first state to ban AI therapists.
Good.
Generative AI has, of course, been all over the news and enough to make you either join the hype train or want to puke. But Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker has signed a bill into law banning AI therapy in the state. Illinois is the first state to regulate the use of AI in mental health services. The law highlights that only licensed professionals are allowed to offer counseling services in the state and forbids AI chatbots or tools from acting as a standalone therapist. This from Engadget. I don't know. What does everyone here think about the potential of AI for mental health care?
You know, as a historian, I am just pleased as punch to be here for this 5-year period when a new technology, or like every technology, the latest iteration of a technology lands into society, and you watch society struggle with the fundamental core beliefs of what even is this and what is that, and oh, we made a robot, it makes paintings, or we have this machine. It's going to be something fascinating to look back on, and I've enjoyed kind of watching the debates. There's a phrase that I've used in the past, and it's not a universal phrase, but I call it punch it in the crib, which is that when you have a technology that people are trying to foist, it is best at that point to ask the questions and not sit back, because historically we have not done that. You know, we say, oh, here's a phone, and the phone can play music, and isn't that great? And people aren't asking any questions. They're just, the toy is working. And then we come back later and, oh, it's encumbered with DRM, or it doesn't have these features, or they don't allow this, and we've lost this because of it. And for AI, AI's getting its due. It can't walk to the, it can't walk out to its car without getting punched because of that, you know? So for me, I'm kind of, whenever people ask me what I think about it, I always say, you know what I like? I liked that one period when a whole range of bosses saw really nascent, not great AI that was hallucinating and just sputtering sparks, and they literally turned to their own employees and said, I can't wait to replace you with this. Because that immediately set expectations for, oh, here's my position in the workforce.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, people usually don't learn that a place doesn't care about them until it's way too late. But for one shining moment, the language isn't there. So they all just go, wow, what is this thing? Oh, a Shoastic parrot that imitates this aspect. Oh, can it be my doctor now? It's like, it can be a bad doctor now. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That to me, watching society wrestle with this and watch it work and people are asking honest, good questions at a time when it may actually affect, you know, it's one thing when we say, oh, I don't know, man, you know, home computers, they may have been a bad idea. It's kind of too late to ask that. But now you can say, well, AI, maybe we don't need, maybe you need to have a talk with your kid about, I mean, all right, and also, I just want to say this, too, as a 50-something. If I was 12 right now,
mm-hmm.
I would be AIing. Like, imagine you're 12, and you wake up, and there's a thing that will do it. Like, you don't know. Mm-hmm. So, of course, like, this thing answers terribly, but it answers really fast. I'd be on that like a bee on sugar, man. That would be my, you know. And I hope my parents would take me aside and teach me a bunch of things because of it.
Mm-hmm.
Good. That's all. Look, man, I just want society to be better. I just want us to be better. I want us to ask questions.
I mean, things just really started going downhill when we lost Smarter Child. Like, that's it. You know, we should have stopped with AI right there. Smarter Child, perfection. But no, I had to take them away.
Absolutely. I like that. We're having a huge thunderstorm outside, and I believe it's being picked up by my mics here and being sent out into the radio, and these ominous bursts of thunder have been underlining this whole conversation about AI and its place in the world, and I can't wait to listen back to this, is all I'm saying.
Yeah, it does lend sort of an air of ominousness to everything we're talking about,
mm-hmm.
but I've also been trying to check, because I think it sounds louder through the mics than it does in our space right now as it is. It's a very strange moment. But the other
By the way, as a fellow New Yorker, my immediate response, my immediate assumption was rent controlled apartment next to the train. And it's just there. That's how it is. It's just, oh no, we forgot to mute every 17 minutes. Oh no. So I'm glad it's just, you know.
Yeah.
It's the rain.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a thunderstorm. But the other thing I was thinking is that every attempt that has been made recently to disrupt the mental health space, obviously none of it is turning out well, because this tech bro ethos of move fast and break things should not be applied to certain fields of endeavor. And I would say the mental health infrastructure, such as it is definitely one of those things. And I think between people not meaning to wind up with AI therapists and winding up with AI therapists, and this whole idea of, you know, just take your problems to a chatbot, it is terrifying in what it could become and what it has become already. Good heavens.
Riders on the storm. Wow.
See, now I'm into it. I love that. this could go. I don't know, man. This AI thing could go either way.
Skynet has joined the chat.
Oh, no, an elder god.
Yeah.
But, yeah, the funny thing about AI as mental health care is it's not by any means new. Back in the 1960s, there was a development called ELIZA, which was a project over at MIT by a programmer called Joseph Weizenbaum. And it was a very simple take on what we would call a modern chatbot. Of course, it was almost 60 years ago, so it was very rudimentary. It would just parrot things back to you. And still, when people at MIT, which, you know, theoretically these are smarter people, were playing with this thing, some people got really into the conversation and were feeling like they were talking to a therapist and would say confidential things to it, which were ending up in computer tapes all over the place. And it was pretty wild. And it was a bad idea then, and it's a bad idea now.
That's absolutely true. I mean, I remember talking to, conversing with Eliza as a kid. But the other thing I was just thinking of now is this whole discussion that people are busy having with the newest update to ChatGPT and these personas that they've constructed in whatever generative chatbot they're talking to have now all disappeared with the most recent update.
Mm-hmm.
And could you imagine if you had decided that that entity was your therapist and then all, like, I cannot imagine, well, number one, how that would work in general, but, you know, I've also been working with the same mental health professional for, like, what, 15 years now, so.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, even with a competent mental health source, if your therapist somehow rebooted and forgot everything that they know about you and your needs, that would be pretty devastating.
That would be pretty devastating. But also the sycophantic nature of so many of the chatbots that has been built in would be terrible for therapy.
Yeah. Yeah, this is... It's worrying. It's worrying, and it deserves keeping an eye on and also continuing to be cognizant of the reasons this is not a good idea. Even if the damn thing worked, it would not be a good idea, and it doesn't. It probably doesn't.
There's a demonstration of technology that I call the kiosk demo, right, which is where you put in a very simplistic interface, right? Like, that's how Google first got everyone's attention. Instead of giving you 1,000 knobs, you just had the Google logo and a little box. And it was like, type it in, and I will do all this work. And the astounding amount of work behind that little simple box to keep it going, both on the human side, right, and also on the technological side. But it was what people expected. And I believe it was the academic Dana Boyd who asked a bunch of children in the last 10 years, like, so what is Google? Like, she had them draw what they thought Google was. What is a Google? Like asking a six-year-old. And, you know, they have these images of big computers in the sky that answer questions, or that they're little creatures that live inside the computer and know everything and have read every book. And in the same way, I mean, look, I get it. If the first time you deal with an AI, like a chat bot situation, let's say a standard, like, type anything, somebody made an earlier AI back in, has to be like 2010 or 11. He tried to make a text adventure kind of AI thing that used many of these models.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I was playing the game and I was walking along a forest and I said, well, let me fly to a city. I just typed it in. It went, well, your gossamer wings extend out. And I was like, that is amazing. But I didn't know all the stuff behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happening now is people are taking what's essentially a cute tech demo that has no run through, and they're like, but wait a minute, let's just connect it to medication. Let's just have it invest in stocks. Let's have it raise my child. And the answer is, no, this is a tech demo. This is like, you know, going down to a convention, and they're showing a dumb little robot they just finished building overnight and just saying, this is going to walk my dog tomorrow. Oh, it's back. The elder god is back.
Here it is.
So here's the thing. I don't know if we're really allowed to speak too ill of AI. Clearly, it's taken over the weather. And when it, excuse me, speaking ill of the AI gods is not acceptable on the radio. Anyway, so that's, like, it is a really interesting time, and people are going to make absolutely grandiose mistakes, and a bunch of really honest, innocent people will think of it as an interesting tool, just mm-hmm. not knowing any better, because they're not hooked into every single, they don't know that using it has these ramifications, and people are trying to educate them, and they're going to have a really rough time. So, although, by the way, the slogan of 2025 is, we're going to have a really rough time. So actually, it just applies for everything.
Absolutely. No, you were saying about, like, if you had had this when you were 12, and I was talking with somebody about this recently. Like, I know the sort of person I was when I was younger would have been very susceptible to getting hooked into this whole scene in very unhealthy ways. I mean, I had the things I was dealing with as a kid, you know, depression, anxiety, social isolation, all sorts of terrible things that left me feeling very lonely. And if I could sit in front of my computer or other small device and have something vaguely shaped like a friend, that would have really... That would have done a number on me, and I am forever grateful that I am the age I am and didn't have to deal with this crap in the media environment, technological environment, whatever, at that stage of my development. It would definitely not have been good for me.
I don't want to derail you, man, but, man, that phrase, I, throughout my life, have had quite a few people in my life who I would have called vaguely shaped like a friend, where it hasn't worked out. Oh, Stephen, he was a nice guy. He was vaguely shaped like a friend until it worked out.
I think we may have one or two of those in common, but but in any case, shifting gears now, I do want to talk about what's coming up this weekend in Kusanagi. I wanted you and Jason to come on here and talk about the things that you're going to be doing. Now, Kusanagi, you are very often to be found at the Hope Conference in a position at the info desk, aren't you?
Yeah, I run the info desk now. It's been great the past 9 years. First, I was a volunteer sleeping behind the info desk because I couldn't afford a hotel room. Now I run the desk and tell everyone to do their thing. So I handle all the volunteer coordination now. Our food trucks, that was me last year. It was me again this year.
Awesome.
What else? I do so much that I forget how much I've actually done. The hotel blocks that are so many of our attendees were able to book rooms at, that was a little bit of the stuff I've done. But yeah, most of the time it's me at the info desk yelling at people, which is really and truly what my passion is, yelling at people while I'm knitting things. I'm doing one of those things right now, but not yelling. And Jason and I, we actually have been hosting the Hackers Got Talent show since its inception, I think, in 2015.
Yeah, back when it was at the Hotel Penn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was this idea of like, well, why don't we just, how do we fill a little bit of time? And the Hotel Penn had a number of stages and these things, and we were like, we don't want to have nothing at night, and what would be really a fun thing? And I think it was just given to me by Emmanuel as a, like, maybe we could do this. And it was, let's do a talent show. And, of course, like a good improv show or a good sketch comedy show, you know, we walk in on Friday having no idea if there's any talent to be had. And then we literally scare up talent. It's like a potluck of performance. And it's got this very honest, hand-hewn feel. Moments that feel like they have to have been scripted. I think my favorite one from last year was like 40 minutes in. I was like, are there any more? Are there any more people? Do we have any? And somebody in the back goes, I have an ocarina.
Yes.
And I was like, let me hear this. You were out there for 40 minutes watching all these acts, and you were like, I wonder if my ocarina might be welcome.
And to be clear for our listeners at home, the act started off with licking my own elbow. Dolphin noises with a great egregious eye contact. That's what we started off with, and then this guy is sitting there with his ocarina the entire time.
The most hackery Hackers Got Talent thing for me was the guy who could do the throat singing, and he brought up a spectrometer to prove that he was throat singing. He had a time-based spectrometer to go, look, see, I'm causing all these harmonics, and I'm like, all right, geek. this talent transfers to nowhere, which is what made it perfect. And so we do that, and that's actually worked out pretty well. And then, you know, I happen to live near Hope, like in terms of a drive and everything else. So for me, it's like my home con now, and it's mostly where I try to like do one or two speeches. This year, I'm doing a workshop. I'm starting to think it might be time to pass on my knowledge in a way that's useful. And this is kind of a dry run for, can I be an educator, or am I one of those professors who's going to get the evaluation of had a fun time, learned nothing? And so we'll see. But my workshop, and I'm wondering how that's going to go because of the phrasing, is about the technique of interviewing for the purposes of historical, oral history and getting knowledge from people and kind of getting down what knowledge exists in people's minds that you otherwise would not get, because they might not be comfortable writing stuff down, but they might be comfortable talking, and what techniques do you use? I'm wondering how many people will show up thinking it's going to be tips on how to win at my job interview, and I may have to do something for them, but we'll see. And what to do when you are interviewed, which to me, honestly, being an interviewer for like 300 people over the years for my documentaries made me a good interview for documentaries. They would ask me to come in because they knew I knew what they needed. So it's a good thing to have. Cheshire Catalyst, bless his soul, showed me his technique when I interviewed him, because before I asked a question, he blasted into a 5-minute presentation on hackers, then stopped and went, "What's your first question?" So that way the editor, who is rushed, could go, "Well, that's all I needed." So he controls the narrative. It was a really eye-opening moment with him. And to be honest, on a more, whatever, sweet note, that's him right now. Part of what I'm trying to do is kind of be part of that that part of like what Cheshire was trying to do, which is be a presence so that people who are, when you have as many panels as there are panels and presentations and events that an event like this has, you got a lot of first timers, both attendee and speaker. You have a lot of people who are looking to understand anything, and being somebody who's dressed fun, looks like they know what they're doing, and is welcoming is important, because you need those folks so that when someone comes up and goes, "I don't even know where the stage is," and I go, "You are in the wrong building, my friend." Mm-hmm. Or, "Where did you, they see you talking to somebody who's," this was something that would happen all the time, right? You'd talk to somebody who was, quote-unquote, famous. Like, they were a name. They had made a book, or they were a hacker of some renown. And talking to someone like me will be a case of, like, oh, if he's talking, I can go up and talk to him. And people feel they don't have to tiptoe around these figures. Because, people are at these cons because they want to meet people. Otherwise, why go? Like, it's not TV. So, I've been very touched by watching some of that go through. So for me, I guess I'm like a knockabout mascot at this point. We'll see how that works out.
Well, we look forward to knocking you about. And, speaking of the conference, tickets are no longer being sold online, the in-person tickets.
The in-person tickets are no longer being sold. I think as of right... Oh, wow, that's a big lightning. I think as of right now, there are still some virtual attendee tickets still available. We're going to be keeping it open until, I believe, around midnight tonight. Your tickets will be processed tomorrow. But if you want to come in person, you need to buy your ticket in person for an increased fee, unfortunately. But
at the door.
And crumbles. Yeah.
It's an emotional support fee.
Yeah.
As a reminder, if you're listening to this archived on Thursday, you can't do that anymore. We're talking today, August.
Ticket sales completely cease for virtuals at the end of August. 13th, I have to read numbers, that's hard. August 13th, 2025. In-person ticket sales up tomorrow, August 14th, at St. John's.
If you are listening to this archived, we didn't know that those thundering sounds were the Elder God, and we send his blessings to you and the life you now live under him.
Absolutely. And, Alex, you're going to be presenting, aren't you?
I am. Presenting twice. You know, at the last one, I think I presented every single day, so three ones. So I'm just doing two presentations today on, this weekend. It will be, I think, Friday at 12 p.m. and then Saturday at 8 p.m. Talking about all kinds of interesting things, and in particular the Saturday talk will be about bridging the gap between the Ethereum ecosystem and the hacker ecosystem, and hopefully demonstrating that the blockchain world is not full of degenerate gamblers and fraudsters, but, you know, we have shared values, and I think we're very aligned in terms of the future we want to see on the internet, as well as the technologies that underpin both the world of the blockchains and the hacker ecosystem as well. So I hope that will be an eye-opening one for many people, and I hope to see many of our listeners there.
It should be fun, and you know, I'm looking forward to this. Once again, I'm actually not on the staff this year, so I get to go as an attendee. I believe you.
I'm also looking forward to this. I am an attendee, and I'm actually in town and healthy this year. So that's very exciting, because that has not been the case for the last couple of events.
Yes.
Well, that's great news.
Great. Yeah. Last year, you could not be there, and I wore a badge with your face on it on my vest.
You certainly did. And this time, I'll just be there.
Yes. But can I still wear the badge? Or?
It'll, instead of the badge with Gila's face, it'll be Gila's face.
However, I suppose that theoretically you could wear the badge on one shoulder and I'll just stand on your other side.
Or you could wear the badge.
A Gila sandwich, or I could wear the badge. That's also true.
I mean, you may be the one person in the world who cannot wear a badge with your face on it.
Where on earth would you come up with an idea like that?
But in any case, it should be interesting. And also, we could use your help. If you're going to the conference, I think there are things you can volunteer for to help with still, and will continue to be over the conference. Kusanagi, could you speak about that a bit?
Very happily. I do want to get a couple things out first. If you're planning on volunteering, we have a system designed for our volunteers at volunteers.hope.net. You can sign up there. Once you sign up, you'll be able to sign up for shifts. This year, we are requiring you to be signed up and checked in before going to your shifts. Just a quick note about the different things available. Tomorrow at 3 p.m., that's August 14th, 2025 at 3, we're actually starting to set up. It'll go pretty quick. It's just getting everything in order. And then for the conference itself, we have a couple of different types of roles. We have the volunteers for the speaker track. Those are MCs and AV. MCs basically guide the speakers to, you know, start and stop on time, help the audience ask questions. There we go. That includes our virtual audience as well. We have, of course, the info desk. If anyone knows stuff about stuff, it's us at the info desk. We'll tell you the Wi-Fi password, where the bathrooms are, where the tracks are, the Wi-Fi password, where the different workshops are located, where the vendors are, the bathrooms, the Wi-Fi password, you know, things like that. We also have security. Those are our wonderful folks who make sure the all our attendees have their badges, make sure that no unticketed people come in. If there's any issues, they will work with me, essentially, to unmake those issues. And for our virtual attendees, if you still want to volunteer, you can. We do have a virtual volunteer spot open, and those volunteers will help with basically just making sure that everything sounds good on our streams. They'll also be answering questions in our matrix, which our virtual volunteers, you should be getting those, our virtual attendees, I'm sorry, you should be getting your codes for matrix very soon. If you are in person, I believe you're going to be getting it at registration when you get there. And like I mentioned earlier, our tickets are going to be on sale starting 3 p.m. on Thursday, August 14th. So if you don't have one, you can still buy one in person. Virtual tickets end tonight, August 13th.
And where can one go to find more information about this?
Oh, there's plenty of places. But hope.net will have the information for tickets, a little bit about our volunteer stuff, where you can go to sign up for the email list for volunteering. And I believe the completed calendars also at hope.net/schedule. I could be wrong. I don't have it up in front of me. What a bad promotion I am. But yeah, so hope.net has everything available. The schedule, bios for talks, speakers, workshops, performances, how to volunteer, where St. John's is, and our code of conduct. All important stuff.
I also noticed that the Hope Schedule app for Android has updated from the previous conference to the current one. So if you had it installed last year and left it there, it's updated, whether you got it from Play Store or F-Droid or whatever. If you don't have it, you can find it there.
Just to clarify, is there an app for the conference that is available for iPhone users?
Great question. At this time, I do not believe there is, unless Hacker Tracker is iOS. If Hacker Tracker is iOS, then yes, it'll be uploaded. It should be actually uploaded today, the schedule for Hope. If it's not iOS, then I'm sorry. We don't have anyone on staff who does iOS anymore. I used to, but no, not anymore.
And, you know, you can always, instead of using a phone app, just bring up the actual website on your phone.
Yeah, schedule.hope.net is the schedule. And you see everything here. It's actually beautifully laid out. Yeah, it's actually really nicely laid out.
And if you're really kicking it old school, there will also be paper schedules, right?
Yes. So outside each of the major talk areas, can I just say the room names? Is that fine?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So outside Marillac Auditorium, Little Theater, and Tobin, those are our three main speaker tracks. We will have paper schedules in front of each door every day, changed by my wonderful volunteers at InfoDesk. We will also generally know when talks are. So if you have a question, please come over and ask us. Just stop asking us for the Wi-Fi password. It's posted up on the wall already. but yeah, so we'll be able to direct you if you know when your talk, if you know what your talk is, or don't know, if you know what talk you want to go to, and you don't know where it is, come ask us. We'll be able to find it for you at info.
One last question I'd like to put to each of you who are on with us, while we got a few minutes left. What would you say, if someone is brand new to attending a conference like this, what's something that you would hope they know? Kusanagi, how about you first?
That's a really, really difficult question. Everyone's a friend to be made. Like, there are no people who come to this conference over the past 10 years, whatever. Numbers are hard. 10 years I've been coming to Hope and been adjacent to the 2600 community. No one's really, like, unfriendly. Everyone's always interested in talking to you, getting to know what your story is. They're friends, and it's okay if you're coming by yourself. This is your first time. Just hang out. Maybe volunteer. You'll be able to meet some people who are new. Maybe you'll go to a talk and learn something that, like, could completely revolutionize your life. Just be open-minded. Go explore. Definitely. That's all I said.
Excellent. How about you, Jason?
Well, I would never tell people how to enjoy their lives, but I will say that the concept of a hacker conference has overgone, you know, all sorts of different ideas over the years, and I've done talks on it. You know, they started 100 years ago when engineers would get together and then drink at night after showing off their works. But in the early 1990s, kids started arranging themselves in backyards, and then why don't we move to picnic tables, and why don't we have it in the park, and why don't we do that, and it would grow. And one of the side effects of that is that different conventions went in different ranges. So many of them kind of became, well, we've been out in the park, but now Stanley works for a security company, so he should talk about his security company. And it became a little bit more about what's our professional take and what that's going to be. And those are dominant. But there's another branch, and I think I put Hope clearly under this, which is just, let's assemble a lot of people with knowledge and curiosity and eagerness, and let's ask those people to either present or engage from the audience or engage in central areas, and let's set up a stage and a meeting space and a town square for all these people to derive of it what they want. And it's not really focused on drinking and partying. It's not focused on selling products. It's focused primarily on, let's have these smart people. You know, there's a tradition for 2600 and other, hacker, you know, magazines and groups and other things, for people to, like, take a train in or drive in to some gathering because they want to be near other people like them. And in that spirit, a lot of that is here. People who are driving from around because they just want to meet a bunch of people in person. They want to see smart people talk, but they also want to just be soldering something in the center of a table and learning something. And then you have people who are bringing in their kids. And I will say that Hope has something really special, which I have been, I don't know, like it blew me away last year, which is that one of the buildings is classrooms. And so traditionally you think of a presentation at a hacker conference, it's a person up with a slide going, wow, I figured out if you do this and do this, the machine doesn't work as well. And I figured out if I do this, I can make the machine do this. But then I walk by and it's just somebody teaching databases. But they're teaching it from a, we only got today, I got to ramp you up, I got to get you going, here's what I've learned, let's all share what we have. And there are... last year I had we always have some shockingly young child become a ham radio operator, and that they come that way because there's a room, there's a place for them.
Absolutely.
So that's what it all is for me.
It really is. And we're going to have to leave it there. Send us email, oth@2600.com. Those of you going this weekend, we'll see you there. For Off the Hook, this is Rob T. Firefly. Have a very good night.